Good morning and welcome to the second day of the South Dakota Supreme Court's October term being held here on the campus of Northern State University. The court would like to welcome students from Aberdeen Central, Britton Hecla, Doland High School, including the Hillside Colony High School students, and Roncalli High School. We have a couple publications available in the lobby if you are interested. They are free for the taking. The light-colored gray pamphlet is a synopsis of the nine cases that we are hearing oral argument on this term. It tells you a little bit about them, the facts and the legal issues. Also tells you a brief biography of the five justices and a short description of how our appellate system works. The second publication that's available is a blue-covered publication with the court's photo on the cover, and this is a pictorial history of the South Dakota Supreme Court, a little history of our institution, and once again a description of how the appellate system works. And if you are interested, help yourselves. The first case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus John T. Pentecost. Mr. Pentecost is the appellant, and for Mr. Pentecost we have Ms. Jamie Patterson, an attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellee we have Ms. Ann Meyer, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. With that, Ms. Patterson, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And again, thank you for the opportunity to argue in front of you for Mr. Pentecost. Justices, the issue before you is one of first impression in the state of South Dakota. The central issue before you in this case is whether or not it's legally permissible to burglarize your own home. That issue, Your Honors, has not been decided in the state of South Dakota, and it touches upon and is central to all of the issues that Pentecost raised in his brief. Your Honor, other jurisdictions have addressed this issue. And first, we'll start with the argument that this court lacked, the trial court lacked subject matter jurisdiction over the offense of second-degree burglary in this case, because we were dealing with a marital home.
Just for the audience, what is second-degree burglary?
Second-degree burglary is a felony offense, and it the key elements are you enter an occupied structure, you don't have a privilege to do so, and you have an intent to commit a crime therein.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On subject matter jurisdiction, the court has jurisdiction, or the circuit court had jurisdiction over criminal matters as subject matter jurisdiction, did it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so how didn't it have subject matter jurisdiction? Maybe it didn't. You're arguing that it didn't violate the statute, but that isn't jurisdiction.
No, Your Honor, and thank you for that clarification. And it's a hair line of distinction. But the issue to decide from Pentecost's position is first and foremost, when you're faced with a burglary charge, whether or not the state can legally proceed if there is in fact ownership title to the property at question. If there is, then you cannot charge someone with that offense. And that's the first issue, and that's what the other jurisdictions have looked at. They looked at common law burglary versus that issue, because if you own your property or you own the structure that you're charged to burglarize, the first issue becomes, if you have a property interest in it, can you burglarize that structure? And the cases in Nevada and Iowa and other jurisdictions, California, have decided that property interest is not the paramount consideration for burglary. But before South Dakota can talk about perhaps a totality of the circumstances test, I submit this court needs to decide and let the state of South Dakota know whether or not it's a bar to even prosecute someone for burglary if they in fact own that house. And in this case,
counsel, isn't that a uniquely factual determination for a jury?
Thank you, Your Honor. It Not if title, Your Honor, could be established clearly, as in this case. One would submit it wasn't clear in this case, but from Pentecost's perspective, it was clear. This was a marital home where the title was still in both Pentecost's name and his former wife. So they had joint tenancy, they had joint title. And we submit that that ownership should be sort of a black letter rule for this state, where if you own your house, you can't burglarize it, much like if you own a piece of personal property, you can't intentionally damage it. And I think South Dakota has strong precedent of being a state that adheres by what can be understood under the rule of law clearly. And I think if we adopt a black letter law that if you own a structure, you can't commit the offense of burglary, I think that would be...
What would be the difference if you burned it down? It's arson, even if it's your own house, but you say you can't burglarize it, but you can legally burglarize it, or whatever you want to detail it, but arson is still a crime on your own house? What's the difference?
Your Honor, I have not, and I apologize, I did not study the arson statutes prior to coming today, so I feel at a loss to argue that sufficiently
right.
for you, and I apologize for that. At any rate, Pentecost would submit that this court should first decide whether or not, if you have legal title to a property, whether the crime of burglary is legally permissible. That doesn't preclude the state of South Dakota from charging a defendant with any other host of crimes that are permitted under the criminal statute that the state believes the actions permit. But that would be the first issue, Your Honors. If this court decides that it is not a black letter law, black letter rule, and it wants to look at more of the totality of the circumstances test, then, Your Honor, this would be a test that also Pentecost would meet. The other jurisdictions have looked at the history of burglary and the common law of burglary, and they've looked at the weighing of protecting the security of occupancy versus property rights. And in those cases, the rule has held that if the defendant had an occupancy or property interest at the time of entry, that the defendant cannot be charged or convicted of burglary, and that is what Pentecost had. Pentecost had a property or tenancy interest at the time of entry. And the fact.
What state are you relying on for that proposition?
Your Honor, I'm looking principally at Iowa in Hagerdorn, and I apologize if I butcher the names as I speak. I'm also looking at McMillan in New Hampshire.
But isn't having an ownership in the home just one factor rather than being solely dispositive?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. And that is one factor. Other factors include the relationship with the party. In McMillan, that was a case of an apartment and a much more much less strong relationship than in Pentecost's case, where it's a marital relationship. So the factors are legal title, relationship with the other party, the length of their separation, and the type and amount of personal property within the structure, and the method of entry. And, Your Honor, these factors are important for the court to consider if the court believes that legal title per se is not a bar to burglary. And in the Pentecost case, what we have is we have Pentecost, who had only been away from South Dakota for about 3 weeks visiting his family in Florida. During that time, his former wife, without his knowledge or permission, changed the locks so that when he came back, they had been changed without his knowledge or permission. That is a significant factor because I believe it was in Hagerdorn, the locks had been changed, but the court noted that the defendant was aware of those change of locks. And Mr. Pentecost indeed had his personal belongings in the house, of which he was alleged to have burglarized. Again, another very important factor that is weighed in whether or not you could burglarize your own house.
Weren't there fact issues, though, that he hadn't been in the house for, or he hadn't been occupying the house for over a year? And weren't there court orders as to who had possession of the house?
Thank you, Your Honor. Another good question.
But these are fact issues, correct?
They are. And as to the question, it is in dispute that he had been. Pentecost's perspective was that he had temporarily left the state of South Dakota to go to Florida. And while it is true that he had not been living day in, day out at the house for the approximate year preceding the divorce to the allegation of illegal entry, his position was that it was still his home and he could indeed live there. So I hope that answers one of your questions.
It's my understanding of the record that he hadn't stayed overnight in the home for more than 1 year.
Your Honor, I apologize. I was not his trial counsel at the lower level, I don't want to say anything that's not true, and so I can't answer that 100%. But I can tell you what I know Mr. Pentecost's position was. And, Your Honor, I remember the other question, which was significant. The other question was court order. Your Honor, in this case, there was no protection order, nor was there any civil injunction prohibiting Mr. Pentecost from entering the marital home. That is another significant fact. If former wife was indeed afraid of Pentecost, she could have sought and obtained a protection order precluding him from entering the marital home during resolution of the sale of their house. Or it could have been a term that she sought as an injunction in the civil proceeding. Indeed, in this case, the former wife was represented by counsel, whereas Pentecost wasn't. And, Your Honor, going to court orders, that is a significant factor, because this court has found when there is an inequality or something that isn't clear in the writing, the clarity or non-clarity, the one that isn't represented, that person should always be more given more of the benefit. And in this case, there was a divorce stipulation and there was a divorce decree. And the divorce stipulation talked about an affective, with an A, transfer of Pentecost's interest in the property upon the divorce. Whereas the divorce decree maintained the party's marital and joint tenancy, their joint ownership in the house. And, Your Honor, we submit A, that controls, because Mr. Pentecost was not represented when the divorce stipulation was drafted against his interest. And two, Your Honors, it is, I believe, undisputed that Mr. Pentecost maintained his ownership interest in the house upon their divorce, because indeed, until when the house was sold, he was entitled to money from the house. So he maintained his title to that. And, Your Honors, I'm not sure on the time, so I do want to...
I think it's probably about 15 minutes in, isn't it, Shirley? Eight minutes.
I think, Your Honors, because of that, I will just brief on the other two issues. They are also very important, and they also go to this issue, can you burglarize your own house, which is an issue, again, first impression. And I stress that because in both of the other two arguments that Pentecost submits, this is an important fact. This is not a well-decided area of law. When Pentecost entered his plea, it is undisputed that he maintained his innocence. He said he didn't burglarize his own house because, indeed, it was a marital home and he was just trying to get his life back together. And the two issues on whether there was on the plea goes to whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in denying Pentecost's motion to withdraw his plea, and indeed whether there was a factual basis sufficient to accept a guilty plea consistent with what due process in the Constitution requires. And when you have a case of first impression, the factual basis becomes very important. And I had the opportunity to speak to Ms. Meyer prior to coming up here, and I appreciate that ability. And Ms. Meyer and I asked her if it was okay if I said this, I believe that this is yet another issue, perhaps the first impression, Your Honors, and that is, whereas when we both went into this, we believed the standard was the more stringent one for whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in denying Pentecost's motion to withdraw its plea, because the motion was filed after the sentence, but Ms. Meyer queried, perhaps that's incorrect. Perhaps that is incorrect, because when Judge Davis ordered Judge Fifley to resentence Pentecost, Well, the motion was then before sentencing, in which case the standard is far more liberal and should basically be liberally construed. And so, Your Honors, I submit that point in your deliberation of this issue because whereas...
But that was the second sentencing.
It was the second sentencing, Your Honor, but I just bring up the point that Ms. Meyer queried that perhaps because it was a resentencing, perhaps this should actually be treated as a motion prior to sentencing, in which case the court adopts the more liberal standard for allowing a withdrawal to plea, and then therefore the abuse of discretion is a different analytical prism than under a motion after sentencing, which is only in manifest injustice.
All right, so what type of a plea was this? Was this an Alford plea? Was this a no contest plea? Or was he pled guilty?
Yes.
That was the plea he entered on the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very important point. It was a guilty plea, and it was not an Alford plea. And that is important because the trial court was not clear on what kind of plea this was in his discussion of whether or not he should allow the motion to withdraw. He stated it was an Alford plea at one point, and this clearly is not an Alford plea. Pentecost pled guilty to the Class 3 felony burglary, a 15-year felony offense, a very serious offense, the highest offense that he was charged out with. He was also charged out with two Class 1 misdemeanors in the alternative, which means that he could be convicted of either misdemeanor, but not both misdemeanors. And a Class 1 misdemeanor is up to 1 year in the local jail. If indeed he had been convicted of a misdemeanor and the state had proved the Part 2 information that pertained only to the misdemeanors, then he would have been looking at one Class 6 felony, which is a 2-year penitentiary maximum. So, in essence, the best case scenario is he pled guilty to the 15-year offense, and the state of South Dakota dismissed one Class 6 felony. Clearly no benefit to that bargain.
How about the cap on the sentence? Now, the state's attorney indicated that they would not ask for the full 15 years. They would ask only for a penitentiary sentence up to 6 years. They'd cap the recommendation, and that's the sentence he received. Is that not also a bargain?
As a criminal defense attorney, with the experience that I have, I would say it's not. I would say it's not for the reason that my client had no prior felony history. And therefore, this was his first felony offense. That is a significant event in anyone's life. As probably the audience knows, if you're a convicted felon, you can't vote. You can't own a gun. This is a big deal. And as a criminal defense attorney that has practiced a number of years, even if you go to trial and you have no prior history and the maximum's up to 15 years, a 6-year penitentiary sentence is not unrealistic for a sentence to receive even after a jury trial. It's not as if he received probation or something. That he received a 6-year penitentiary sentence on his first-time felony. So from that perspective, Your Honor, I would say it was not a benefit. And I appreciate the question. And I will touch on the last issue of the sufficiency of the factual basis. Again, that goes to this being a case of first impression. When the court is required under the statute, under 23A7-2 and 23A7-14, that an adequate factual guilty before a guilty plea is accepted must be established. And again, I'm going to probably butcher the name, and I apologize, but the key case that I would want the court to look at would be Nachtigall, N-A-C-H-T-I-G-A-L-L, which was recently quoted in State v. Apple. And to establish a factual basis for each element of offense is essential to a knowing and voluntary plea. And that, Your Honor, goes back to one of your first questions of what are the elements of burglary. And two of the key elements in this case were not adequately established, that being, do you have a privilege to enter? And that being, thank you, intent to commit a crime therein. And I'll just briefly touch on the intent to commit a crime therein. This was based on stalking. And the stalking statute requires harassment. And harassment requires that there be no legitimate purpose. And in Pentecost's case, and from his perspective, again, he was entering his marital home. He was trying to resolve a very messy situation. And he had a legitimate purpose to be there. And, Your Honors, I appreciate very much your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the Court. The state's position is that jurisdiction is clean. It's been fixed. You sent it back down. It's been cleaned up. If there was no jurisdiction, we would never be able to address some kind of case of new impression. We wouldn't be able to look at the modern understanding of how burglary in a domestic situation is evolving. And so we just wanted to clear that up. As far as the standard of review, in preparing for the oral argument, because this case went back down for resentencing in 2014, and we started over from go, in my brief, I said that it was a manifest injustice, and in looking at that, it may be a different standard of review. It would be in favor of a liberal withdrawal if that's how the, because it was before he was sentenced when we started over. Nevertheless, there's no absolute right to withdraw a guilty plea. And what you're seeing in other jurisdictions is an analysis that includes a number of factors, a totality of the circumstance, who's in possession of the home, who's got occupancy. In this case, we have a marital relationship that's over. He knows it, she knows it. And he knows he's not welcome in that home. And he goes in anyway. And they have been separated for a long time, over a year, about a year and a month. And he hasn't been living in the home during that time frame. Justice Kern was correct. It has been in the hands of his ex-wife. So he decides to make a surprise visit, shows up with a number of suspicious articles like ties for your hands and duct tape and tape. And she's terrified. He is sending her multiple text messages and cell phone messages, and she contacts the police. Now, they've been separated for an extended period of time. So if you take all these factors together, plus we have a red flag on their divorce documents. In the property settlement, it says that he has relinquished his interest in the property and that he's turning this over to her. She's to actualize the sale of the house. She's to take care of that portion of their deal. They made a deal. He's on notice. He's not welcome there. She's handling that. And he still goes ahead and decides he's going to get a piece of his life back. The truth behind the situation is that he's making a power play to get back in the home to reconcile with her, and she doesn't want that. And his method of entry, even though he had a key, it didn't work. He didn't have a key after a year and a half because she'd moved on with her life. And he changed the locks with a local locksmith to keep her out. She comes home from her job and can't get into her residence. So what we're saying is the better reasoned analysis is the one from other jurisdictions. We're asking this court to go that way. South Dakota hasn't been presented with that question before, but it looks like a majority of the states have gone that way. Other jurisdictions are finding that this would constitute second-degree burglary. And in the alternative, even if there was a joint ownership issue here, Justice Gilbertson brought up the fact that we had a case a long time ago called State v. Hayes when a defendant burglarized and committed arson in a commercial building that he owned with his father. That was still considered burglary and arson because he didn't have permission to go into the part of that commercial building that belonged to his father, and that same analysis would apply here by analogy. Now, with respect to the motion to withdraw his guilty plea, the court was very clear. He said, I made a record of the factual basis for the plea. It includes the divorce documents, the pleadings of the parties. It includes the grand jury transcripts. It includes the police reports. And he said, we talked about the ownership of this property at length. He found that the plea was in the nature of an Alford plea because the defendant, you don't have to admit guilt, but you are subjecting yourself to the jurisdiction of the court for punishment. And he said, I made that clear to you. We discussed all these things. There's no merit to withdrawal of that plea. I think I've covered the factual basis, but I did want to point out it can come from anything in the record. It can come from the prosecution, the defendant. It can come from autopsy records. It can come from a pre-sentence report. And the court was very careful to make his record to say that I'm including additional information in this record that comes from outside of it, and I'm detailing that. If there are no further questions?
I guess not.
Okay, we'd ask that you deny relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Ms. Patterson, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Two points to address. One, the state said that Mr. Pentecost had, I understood her to mean this, that Mr. Pentecost did not have a key for a year and a half. That's not the information I possess. The information I possess is that his personal belongings were in the marital house, even post-separation. He had access to the house because he had a key, and he didn't learn that he couldn't get back into the house until he returned back from his temporary stay in Florida. So I think, again, that's an important fact for the court to be aware of. And I just want to talk a little bit more about the sufficiency of the factual basis, because the state talked about that. Natchkal talked about, in cases where the defendant is proclaiming their innocence while at the same time pleading guilty, the factual basis to support such plea must be strong. And Natchkal talks and cites to South Dakota Supreme Court that cites to Alford. And this factual basis in this case was not strong. Again, this goes back to this being a case of first impression in the state of South Dakota. At the same time that the defendant proclaimed his innocence while the guilty plea was being entered, the issue of whether you can burglarize your own house, which was what Pentecost was maintaining was not possible, the trial court was accepting a guilty plea. I would submit in cases like this, which is a first impression of a first impression, if the law is one of first impression, you almost have to have an ironclad factual basis, not one like this, not one where the defendant himself is questioning the validity of law that has not been established in the state of South Dakota. And therefore, I would submit the factual basis was very tenuous at best, and the lower counsel's argument that a mistake of fact would not be a defense in a case where a mistake of fact might indeed be a mistake of law or a charge that isn't even legal. This was a mess. This was frankly a mess. And I...
Well, factually, a part of your mess, am I wrong that in the divorce decree the house was to be sold and the proceeds split up between the parties, but didn't it include a clause that the decree shall operate as an effective transfer of Pentecost's interests?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, that is the divorce stipulation language. That is not the divorce decree language.
Did the decree incorporate the stipulation?
It would, but that goes back to the important point that the stipulation that you're citing to was drafted by former wife's counsel and had Pentecost pro se sign it. And
he did sign it, though.
Pro se. And
he signed it, though.
He signed it.
Pro se or not.
Pro se. But that's an important fact because from Pentecost's perspective, the divorce stipulation that you've just cited to the affective transfer language conflicts with the language in the divorce decree signed by the trial court. And the divorce decree maintained, as is not in dispute, the joint tenancy legal interest to the marital property. It talked about how the plaintiff, who was former wife, upon sale of the house, would be transferring the parties, plural, interest, title. So there was a conflict between the divorce decree, the actual order, and a stipulation drafted by former wife's counsel, at the detriment of a pro se party. And
all right, so let's assume hypothetically that he had a claim of legal ownership. Now, he hasn't lived hypothetically in the home for more than 1 year. He arrives at the home. He knows that she's living there and that she has expressed that he is not wanted there. He hires a locksmith, goes into the house with items of restraint. He's got duct tape, cable wraps, a sales slip for the purchase of a recent handgun. He has a shotgun and ammunition in the car, a suicide note, and a last will and testament. He then tells or texts her that he's there in the home. Does she not have any sense of security or right to be secure in her home? I mean, isn't that the principle that the burglary statute is designed to protect, an individual's sense of security in their home? I mean, otherwise, anytime we have someone with a pending divorce and one party's living in the marital home and the other party's not, is that carte blanche permission to enter into that home? Would there have to be a protection order in every case to grant the spouse or the person still in the home that sense of security?
Thank you, Your Honor. A very good question. And I think, Your Honor, that's one of the central questions this court will have to answer if it decides that ownership in a structure that's alleged to be burglarized is a per se bar to that charge. And, Your Honor, you're correct. In the other jurisdictions that have looked at this issue, they have looked at, look, burglary is not just about property. The concern is what you've talked about. The concern is of the interest of the occupant and the safety of others, frankly. That's what they talk about. But they talk about, even in those, and I believe it's Hagerdorn, that the test becomes whether or not the defendant had an occupancy or property interest at the time of entry. I believe that was the rule in Hagerdorn that they laid out. And, Your Honor, that also encompasses the concerns you've talked about, because from Prendergast's perspective, he still had an occupancy and property interest at the time of entry. Indeed, he talked about how he was just trying to get his life back. And while, Your Honor, the state would submit that the wife was very clear that she did not want him in the house, from Prendergast's perspective, that was not so clear. From his perspective, they could still live in the house until it was sold. And indeed, the divorce decree or the stipulation talked about the immediate sale of the house, which did not occur. The wife kept it going for a year, kept contact with Prendergast. They texted. His property was in the house. I mean, this is, for lack of a better word, a mess. And whereas what Prendergast did or didn't do in August of 2012, the state of South Dakota has an arsenal of charges that they can charge Prendergast on for behavior they find criminal. But, Your Honor, I would submit that burglary is just not one of them. And I think that this court should be very clear on what constitutes a burglary. And in this case, Your Honor, I submit that this is a case where whatever happened was not burglary, and I would ask that you grant Prendergast's brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson. You actually have 2 minutes left, but it's